The Allergy Mom podcast is not intended to provide listeners with medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Individuals with health problems should always consult their healthcare provider for professional medical advice, medications, or treatments. Reliance on any information provided during this podcast is done solely at your own risk. You're listening to the Allergy Mom podcast, hosted by Melissa Scheichel, an educator, advocate, speaker, author, counselor, and best of all, allergy mom. Subscribe now for the latest news, tips, hot topics, and answers to your questions and concerns about living a life with allergies. Now, here's your host, Melissa Scheichel.
Welcome to Season 2, Episode 1 of the Allergy Mom podcast. Happy New Year. It is 2022. I hope this finds you healthy and well and escaping or avoiding COVID as much as possible. It is crazy here where I live. We are back in lockdown and it feels like March of 2020, unfortunately, as opposed to 2022. But silver lining, which if you listen to this podcast regularly, you know that I'm a fan of those and that I always look for those. The silver lining here is that I have time to work on my podcast. I'm working from home and I'm really excited about this next season as my intention is to include more interviews that relate to mental health, parenting, and family life. For anyone who is the parent of a child with a health condition, you know that all those normal things that parents worry about, you know, your child's mental health, how to parent, rules, interactions with family members, those are all exacerbated by these conditions and by the stresses that accompany having a child with a chronic health condition. And so, you know, as a psychotherapist and clinical social worker, it's really important to me to bring an awareness to that and to support through, you know, this community, the information and awareness of mental health and the need for addressing that. You know, we work really hard to keep our kids physically healthy and safe, but there are so many mental health considerations, the stress, the trauma, the grief, the anxiety that goes along with this are real, and anything we can do to make that easier to support our kids and our families is really key. So here we go. I'm going to kick this off with an interview today with Dr. William Doherty. I found out about him through a book that I purchased in the summer called The Intentional Family. You know, I talk a lot about seasons and ages and stages of a family life, and my kids are teenagers now, and so a lot of the daily rituals that we had when they were little, such as tucking them in for bedtime and reading a story together, and those daily rituals that connect and bond us to each other, we don't have those as much as our kids become older and more independent. And so I bought this book with the hopes of learning some new ways of creating those types of rituals in our day-to-day life. I'm really good at Christmas and holidays, but wanted to have, you know, an intentional, regular means of connecting with my kids on a daily and weekly basis. So I read the book, really enjoyed it, and reached out to Dr. Doherty asking if he would like to be a guest on the podcast, and was thrilled when he said yes. So I welcome him here today. I hope you enjoy our conversation. A little bit more about Dr. Doherty. He's the professor of family social science and director of the Citizen Professional Center at the University of Minnesota. He is also a marriage and family therapist and the co-founder of the Doherty Relationship Institute. He has won numerous awards. He is the past president of the National Council on Family Relations, the oldest interdisciplinary family studies organization in North America. He received the Significant Contribution to the Field of Marriage and Family Therapy Award from the American Association for Marriage and Family Therapy. He's a national leader in the movement to solve the problem of overscheduled kids and underconnected families. Prominent in his work are four community initiatives focused on reclaiming family time in the hurry-up world of contemporary childhood. He has appeared in a wide range of national media outlets about this issue, including Oprah, The New York Times, USA Today, all of the major network morning shows and evening news programs, Time, and National Public Radio's Talk of the Nation. He's written several books, including the one I referenced, The Intentional Family, which highlights the problem of time famine in families and the decline of family rituals, shows readers how to use everyday rituals such as dinners, bedtime talks, outings, to reclaim family balance in an out-of-control world. He also wrote the book, Take Back Your Kids, Confident Parenting in Turbulent Times, which won the Forward Magazine's Parenting Book of the Year Award. He wrote Take Back Your Marriage, Sticking Together in a World That Pulls Us Apart, which also won a Self-Help Book of the Year Award. And he wrote books on marriages and taking back your wedding, managing the people stress of wedding planning. So definitely someone who knows a lot about the struggles of family life, of marriage, of relationships, and parenting. Welcome, Dr. Doherty.
Welcome to Dr. Doherty. Thank you for joining me on my podcast. I wanted to reach out because I really enjoyed your book, The Intentional Family, and thought that it would be great to have a chat with you and that my listeners would really appreciate all of your wisdom on this topic.
So all welcome. Right, let's do it.
So maybe you could start with just introducing yourself and give us a little bit of your background and what your passions have been over the years and where you focused your energy and your time and your expertise.
Yeah, well, I do a lot of different things. So I teach at the University of Minnesota, I teach family studies and family therapy, and I practice marriage and family therapy. I've worked in medical settings, co-founded something called Medical Family Therapy. I work with families who are dealing with medical issues. Right now I do a lot of work on political depolarization, sort of couples therapy for the nation.
Okay, for wow.
The red-blue divide.
Sounds good.
So lots of different things. And most relevant to what we're doing here is that way back in the 70s, I became interested in family rituals. It actually started off with me being asked to give a talk on the family dynamics of Christmas time for families that do the Christmas holidays. So that got me really thinking about the fascinating dynamics of families at that season. And then that led to just a more general interest in family rituals and family time. I wrote a couple of books on this topic. So, yeah.
Yeah. As I said, I picked up your book, and I think what drew me to it was I talk a lot on my podcast about ages and stages. So, you know, my podcast focuses on living a life for most of my listeners. They have a child or family member with severe food allergies, anaphylaxis. And mm-hmm. so, you know, how that journey changes over different ages and stages.
Yeah.
I'm also a psychotherapist, social worker, so I work a lot with families just on general family life. And mm-hmm. people often approach me at those different ages and stages because, you know, we kind of get comfortable and then everything changes.
Right. Darn it. Don't you hate that?
Yes. Just when you feel like you're getting the hang of things. So, you know, personally, I felt like I was really good at the early years with my kids and having rituals. You know, we had our bedtime ritual and I felt really confident. And now that mine are 15 and 16, I realized we'd lost a lot of that. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to investigate that. And I read your book and there's a really great quiz that you have at the end, a little evaluation there of how you're doing. And I was really shocked that I was doing less well than I thought I would have guessed. So I think I'm very good at being intentional about the holidays mm-hmm. and have our, you know, kind of annual things that we do, but it was more those daily rituals and how I greeted my kids when they returned home and we had dinner time. You know, again, I thought I was quite good at having family meals, but just there were things I could do to improve, mm-hmm. you know, you had suggested in the book, setting the scene, setting the mood for dinner time. So we've been doing that since September of, you know, turning out the lights and lighting a candle and having some dinner music and just how conducive that is to connecting and kind of blocking out some of the other distractions, maybe the phones and those things that teens are pretty preoccupied with. So I get those little times. I'm also applying the date nights that you suggested. So
okay.
Those times with my kids where I'm not using that as an opportunity to nag them, which I might have previously done.
Uh-huh.
But some of your suggestions, it was that was, you know, we have this intentional time where it's really about bonding and having an enjoyable time together. And we can do all that other stuff.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Those intentional quality times. So,
hey, that makes me feel good. An author always feels good if somebody actually tries what they write and it works.
I signed my kids right away. We did some volunteer work last week for our local food bank. So they're like, what is going on with you? I'm very intentional. But they seem to be responding really well.
Oh, good. Good.
Yeah. So maybe you can speak a little bit just about, you know, intentional family life and if you have any recommendations for things people can try or where the pitfalls are.
Sure. Sure. Yeah, just the kind of pace and flow of distractions of contemporary life and family life are such that if you're not intentional, by that I mean mindful, planful, what we tend to do is sort of drift apart over time. I use this analogy about the Mississippi River. You know, I live in St. Paul, Minnesota, and the Mississippi River is nearby. And so if you're starting out in family life, if you're like putting a canoe in the river, and if you don't paddle, you go south.
Yeah.
And actually to stay even where you are takes some work. And if you want to head north, that really takes some navigational plans, okay? And so it doesn't mean there's something wrong with the family. It just means that if you're not intentional, you will gradually lose some connections, and you know you'll get them back at special occasions and other. But there's some richness that you lose. So how to be intentional? And what I say is that rituals are one of the best ways to do that. And by ritual, I mean something you do over and over. So not just one-off. It's coordinated so people know what they're doing. You're not making it up from scratch each time. So there's this comfort level of, you know, this is what we do. This is how we do a meal together. So predictable. Over and over, coordinated. And the third one is significant. It has emotional meaning. So I distinguish a routine from a ritual. Routine is repeated, okay, and it's coordinated, but it doesn't have any particular emotional meaning or significance. So people have to eat, right? And so you can just sort of have a food event, right? With the cell phones out or the TV on or people coming, going from the table, everybody gets fed. But it's not a ritual because you're not doing something that has emotional significance or meaning. So I always talk about I grew up with two parents and five kids in one bathroom. And so, you know, the wow. morning, there's a routine. I mean, you didn't linger in there, you know, so it was repeated. It was coordinated, but I don't get misty-eyed thinking about the bathroom. Okay? But I do when I think about the best times in my childhood. They were on a regular basis, the family dinner, always at 6 o'clock, and my father, you know, that's where I knew he was the Irish storyteller. He would tell stories. And I learned at some point, if you want to get airtime, you tell stories too, okay? Annual vacation where, you know, we played with our parents. You know, in those days, you didn't play with your parents so much, but they would play with us. So anyway, most of the time, kids don't remember when they grow up a single thing we ever said to them. But they remember the time we spend with them. And particularly the ritual time. So that's why it's so important.
It reminded me of when I was a child, we would go to the dentist. So my mom would pull me out of school for a dentist appointment, mm-hmm. and we would Harvey's and grab a burger. And for some reason, that was just such a special time because every time we went to the dentist, I knew we were going to go out and we were, you know, it wasn't anything fancy. It wasn't anything crazy, but it was that, you know, I had her undivided attention and it was something we did every time and I could look forward to it. And yeah, it's funny how these things stand out.
And it even made going to the dentist okay.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, I mentioned the holidays and having a child with food allergies. I think, you know, that's where you kind of really struggle as parents because you've got a lot of traditions and a lot of, you know, customary foods and activities that all of a sudden you don't know how to function because, you know, you can't do it the way that you've always done it. And so I think that's something that I've shared a lot about in my blog and when I'm talking about it, because it was something that was so challenging. And there's a lot of emotion around, you know, these things that the way we've always done it. So when you're trying to change a ritual or, you know, one of these traditions, you know, with some resistance and you address that a bit in the book and maybe you can speak to, you know, how do that and keep everyone happy.
So a ritual has to have some discipline to it. It has to have some structure, has to have some boundaries, you know, for it to not just be chaos. And in fact, the idea that we do it a certain way, you know, and the, you know, like Thanksgiving in the U.S., you know, Thanksgiving meals, you know, it's the same menu kind of thing, right? And so some of the comfort, or for a family that does a Christmas presents, for example, and the tree, you know, you do the presents one time, you do the tree sometime, or like a birthday party, you know, you always have to sing happy birthday, you know. So some of maintaining rituals is holding to the predictability. Doing it in a similar way. However, but the other part of it though is that you have to have enough flexibility. Okay, so you have to have a certain amount of rigidity, right? But you have to have a certain amount of flexibility. And you mentioned at the beginning of our conversation, kids getting older, new stages, new ages.
You're not going to pin the tail on the donkey anymore at the birthday party,
right? Exactly. Exactly. And at some point, your kids are not going to want bedtime stories, right? When they're teenagers, they tuck you in bed, you know? So you have to have that flexibility. So if you have a child or another family member with some particular food issues, and, you know, particularly ones that are health issues, not just somebody doesn't like something.
Yeah.
You know, then you have to be flexible. And the key there is, what's the goal? What's the goal? Okay, what's the end you're looking for? The means to it are not the goal, right? The goal is connection. And everything else is a means towards that. And so the question is, how do you get to the goal with altering the means, instead of getting hung up on, gee, we're not having this favorite food, or you have to cook some special extra food. Just not letting that stand in your way, because what you're interested in is the goal, which is the connection.
Yeah, that's what I found we really had to focus on. So the idea is, we're getting together as a family for, you know, this really special time of year so that we can have a lovely time, and we can't get hung up on those, you know, traditional way things always have been. It's going to be new, but we're creating these new intentional rituals. And there are foods now that I only make at Christmas time, because that's really special then, right? It's like, oh, Mom, will you make, you know, my favorite peppermint patties in June? Nope, that's a Christmas thing. And it's
there, you go.
That kind of excitement and that.
There you go. Yeah. So you're protecting by saying, no, I'm not going to make that treat. You're protecting the ritual.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
More valuable, right?
It does. It just reminds me, this isn't family stuff, but it just reminds me the Rocky Horror Show, that cult film. There were rituals around it. My wife and I went to it a couple of times. You know, the kids turn out and they bring rice and they do all this stuff. Well, it finally came out on a VHS. Remember the old VHSs?
Yeah,
so you can watch it anytime. It ruined it.
It ruined it. Exactly.
Yeah, because you could.
It's not that special
anymore. That's right. So that's the holding something special, but being flexible about how you do it. Now, we might want to talk about the challenges with extended family.
Mm-hmm. I loved that you did that in the book as well. You really gave different scenarios for different kinds of families and also the extended family, because that is a huge challenge, I think, of the people that I talk with in this community face, because different generations really stuck on the way things should be, right?
Right.
Yeah, I'd love to hear your thoughts on that.
So particularly for big family rituals, the big rituals often are intergenerational. And in fact, I don't talk about it in the book, I don't think, but subsequently from the book, the intentional family, I talk about traditions. So a tradition is something that's passed on across generations. So it's a ritual that's passed on across generations. So, and so they take on special meaning, and the special foods, and the, you know, grandpa comes as dressed as Santa or whatever, and you have to do it the same way. It's part of what makes them special. But when you have a child who can participate in some of those aspects of the tradition, in fact, when it's a health hazard, right? I mean, when it's
like coloring Easter eggs, if your child's anaphylactic to eggs.
This is not like, oh, my kid doesn't like certain, you know, do certain activity. Well, in that case, you just say they don't have to do it. But for particularly the older generation, they may have gotten very attached to the specifics. And when they were coming of age and having their kids, we didn't know a lot about food allergies.
Yeah.
What we knew about was some kids are fussy eaters, thank you.
Yeah.
We didn't understand that. Sometimes they're fussy because it really hurts them.
Bothers their systems.
Yeah. And then they're sick for days afterwards. So so each generation has certain things it's aware of and certain things that they're not aware of raising their kids. And it's really, I understand it. It's tempting to say we raise our kids okay. Every generation thinks that the next one are too indulgent.
Right.
So it can seem like the parent is overreacting, too anxious, or too indulgent.
Right.
And then you get these zings. You get zings, you also get just refusal, right? You get people, I imagine you hear that, putting stuff in front of your kid that's hazardous.
Yeah, right? My daughter was allergic to dairy, so, you know, anaphylactic. And so I would get comments like, well, we usually put butter on the outside of the turkey. She could just eat the meat on the inside. Like, really didn't recognize that would be very dangerous for her. But
yeah,
you know, kind of an unwillingness sometimes to change. We get really attached to the way things are done, right?
Right. So. And this partly comes with age. They've even old animals, so they say, like, they can't teach an old dog new tricks. I mean, this so here's the thing, that what it requires, I think, on the parents' part is compassion and understanding for why some things are difficult to change, and why the elders might want to just sort of push the envelope on it, right?
Yeah.
Right. I like, butter on the outside, right? So understanding, so you don't think they're out to hurt your kid.
Right.
But also some firmness of boundary setting.
Mm-hmm.
Some things are just not negotiable.
Yeah.
And so if you lack the compassion, then you return intolerance with intolerance. And that doesn't really help the family relationships.
Divisive, right?
Right. So not intolerant, but I have some responsibilities for my child. And I recommend that the conversations about adapting the ritual, like the food, for your child, that those occur well before the event.
Right.
Okay. Thanksgiving at 2 o'clock in the afternoon is not the time for the negotiation.
When someone shows up at your door with a pecan pie and you say, we can't have any nuts, that's not the time to be breaking that news, right?
That's right. That's right. And not the time when the butter on the turkey, because I can understand that. I mean,
yeah.
You know, you can think, well, the kid doesn't slather butter all over the bread, you know, but a little on the outside. So it just, you know, I try to have the compassion to think there's some things that I pay a lot of attention to because they're really important to me and my family. And other people just don't pay as much attention to. In fact, I was remembering recently when, you know, the early days of concern about saturated fat and so on. I remember talking to a family member about that, and she said, well, we always cut the fat off at the, you know, well, yeah, you don't like eat a spoonful of fat on the edge of the steak, you know, you cut that off. But there just wasn't a lot of cultural awareness at that point of what saturated fats are and where they come from. That people thought about fat as the thing you could see. Right.
Right.
So,
And like you said, then they think you're being too paranoid. It was fine.
Yeah. So I think of it as a lack of cultural wisdom about certain things. But each generation gets wiser. So you're on an airplane now, and they'll say, "We have some folks with peanut allergies, and if you bread or nut allergies, bring those along. Please don't. We're not serving them, and please don't open them." Yeah. Well, you hear that enough and you think, man, this is a serious issue, right? When the airlines are doing that.
I've been in that situation many times and it used to frustrate me to no end because I thought if only they would make that announcement in the waiting area or prior before people bought their snacks, because I would have this empathy for these people that they've gone and bought a snack. Yeah. To eat on the plane. And now all of a sudden they're finding, I just wasted my mind. I can't eat this. And it's frustrating. So you can have, you know, some compassion for that.
Right. Well, that makes sense. Yeah. So the best practice would be beforehand. But my point is that that's fairly new. I've been traveling on planes for, you know, decades. That's fairly new, which means there's more awareness.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And so part of our job as parents is to respectfully educate elders and others. It can, not just elders, I don't want to blame, it could be in-law, you know, be siblings and sibling-in-law, you know, lots of folks who haven't encountered food allergies and in their life, and they just haven't encountered it. So it's my job to help them understand it better and to help them not lose face right at the moment, right? So they come in with the pecan pie, and then, you know, at that point, they're going to feel stupid.
Yeah.
Right? And defensive. Mm-hmm. And most of us are not at our diplomatic, compassionate best when we feel foolish and stupid.
Right.
What a lot of people do is they'll either over-apologize, in which case you feel bad to make them so miserable, right?
Yes.
Or they go, oh, come on. You know, I'm not saying your kid has to eat this pie, or, you know, the peanuts are over there, right? So they get defensive. So it's our job to anticipate that this could be a tricky situation, and to have the conversations well in advance, to have more than one if necessary, to bring it up in a way where you're going to listen to them and say, yeah, I know it probably doesn't seem to make sense. And another area wasn't around. You know, this is the real deal. You know, if you're interested, I can send you some links, but it's the real deal. And and then to tell some stories, right? I mean, right? You don't find out your kid has these allergies until you've had some bad experiences.
Right. That came to my mind, the thought of storytelling and how you can, you know, kind of create, you know, honor those traditions. So what is it that's so special to you about, you know, the way things have always been?
Yeah.
And you know, now here's what we're going through, you know, can and how do we, like you said, have a great time and, right. and find some new traditions or some new ways of doing it so that everyone's safe. And
And it might be that initially you're just carving out a boundary. There are certain things that won't be there. And originally there might be some begrudging acceptance. But then sometimes people get maybe a little more creative.
Yeah.
And so so it's neither being kind of arrogant about this, which would be, if you are in my life and you love this child, you should be as concerned as I am. What's wrong with you that you're not? That's arrogance. Mm-hmm. And the other is being a pushover on this, apologetic and blah, blah, blah. And so finding the middle ground.
Yes.
But the big thing about ritual is that conflict undermines rituals. And so if you're going to engage in a conversation that could be difficult, have it before the ritual or have it after when you're going back over it, but don't have it during, because then, and you probably remember this in the book, the worst thing is to be accused of ruining.
Yes.
Ruining Thanksgiving.
We used to joke about that in the family. You're the one who ruined Christmas. I laughed in the book because we've said those words. Oh, you're the one that's here.
Ruined. That's right.
The one.
That's right.
There's always one.
So if you are not mindful about how you're going to bring this up, you can be the one who is, we're having a perfectly good time until, you know, Melissa, you know, blah, 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 you know, and then you hurt your case.
And, you know, then also how does my child feel? Because I might be the one fighting that battle, but they know it's because of their health condition that this fight is on. And that's, you know, really delicate. So
no, that's
really not wanting to have those conversations.
It's hard enough, without feeling a kind of public shame.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Oh, that's really good. I loved that in the book, just, you know, really contemplating the term, you know, intentional and thinking it's this mindfulness. And as you said, like being proactive, and you talked about having, you know, this foresight of what are the potential pitfalls, right? So if we're going to do things a different way, you know, how do I avoid possible conflicts and how do I avoid people being bored? So you talked about going for walks and things like that, which is, you know, activities. You're trying to kind of mitigate the possible pitfalls of these events. And like you said, rather than just kind of flowing into it,
and then being upset. Right.
Yeah.
So the thing about families, family rituals, is that it's not your first rodeo with your family. Okay. things that go wrong tend to be the same things that go wrong.
Yeah.
So examples for you know, like a Thanksgiving or a big holiday or, you know, a big family gathering. Some people don't do any work and other people do all the work and then they feel used. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, if that goes on year after year, you can maybe do something about it. You know, so I think I may have mentioned in the book that somebody I interviewed about this. When people would arrive at the family meal, this was Thanksgiving meal, she would have them pick a piece of paper out of a hat. She'd hold up a hat and they'd pick one out. And that was their work job.
That's awesome.
Okay. And then people could compare notes. They could trade if they wanted. So she met them at the door with a fun thing. And because for years she was left doing too much and then getting somebody to help. And then they'd be resentful. And then, you know, and then you kind of get irritable. And then you're accused of ruining it. You know? So, right. I mean, and it's in the classic gender roles. The men are watching football and the women are doing the work. And like this gets pretty old. It doesn't work to at some point get frustrated and saying, why are you guys doing such and such? You know, then you're the spoil sport. So. Make it like everybody has something to do.
Love it. I've been doing that as well. So since I read your book, I started on Mondays and Tuesdays. We've got one of those food delivery services where you can pick your meal ahead of time and they deliver all the ingredients and the recipe. And so now I have one child cooking one night and the other one cooking the other night, and I'm their sous chef. So it's a bonding activity. I'm there to help.
Nice.
they want to do most of it because they enjoy it. And then the other child who didn't cook is on cleanup with me after. And it's been really good. And
I
you said about, you know, even the people who are doing nothing, they actually feel better when they contribute and help out.
Absolutely. Absolutely. The consumer approach to family rituals is not nearly as good as the co-creation of them.
Mm-hmm.
You have this alternating approach. You get some one-to-one time. I imagine the cook has some role in deciding on the menu.
Yes, I encourage them to, they don't do it because I don't know why. I thought they would be more excited about picking it, but I know what they like. But that was kind of my intention, was that they would go on there and get to choose the meal that appealed to them, so they get to pick for that. So far, they're happy with what I've picked, but maybe if I pick the wrong thing, they might be more involved next time.
Well, so if I could do a little coaching.
Yes, love that.
How far in advance are you discussing what they're going to prepare?
Usually around a week in advance.
Okay, so even at that time, they're not.
I'm texting them the link, and they can just go on and pick, and it's like choosing off a menu, so I thought they would quite enjoy doing it.
Okay.
But they're preoccupied with other things, I think.
Yeah. So you're two-thirds of the way there, but I'll just, if it's okay, I mean, one, if you wanted to get them more involved, because it would be even better.
Yeah.
It would be to sit down and not put anything in front of them.
Okay.
Ask them and just sort of interview them, and it just may take a few minutes, but in a sense, it's a blank piece of paper. They have to fill the paper.
Right. Get them to kind of pick what they would like and what their ideas are, what would be.
Yeah, there. With you not giving them a multiple choice.
I see. Yes. Okay.
And the thing is to do it with no sense of impatience or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
I'll tell a little story about that for myself. my wife has always been in charge of the Christmas presents. And so then... and even for my family at some point. And, you know, so there's a piece of my brain that I never developed, you know, I mean, how do you think about your presence? But she would say, so how about your family? And then she already had about five ideas and I had none. And so she would say, I don't know. And then she'd come up and I said, that's good. But that's not the same thing as me actively thinking.
Totally generating the ideas. Yeah.
So we did a little switch. Where when we would discuss my family's presence, she would not offer anything at first. That was me to go first. And then it'd be like a little piece of my brain gets activated then.
Yeah, and the engagement. And then you would have, I would imagine, so much more satisfaction when they received the gift because it's actually something that you had really been invested in.
That's right. That's right. And then my wife was on the spot and all that kind of thing. But what it took was a little bit of switch in our conversation where she literally put nothing in there to start with.
Yes, I see what you're saying.
Okay. And not in a one-up way, not in a lecture way. Like, I'm always the one, and blah, blah, blah. Then you have an argument about it.
Right.
No, it's just hold back. And with her holding back, Then of course, since she's better at choosing presents, she consults with me just like you would with your kids. You know, if there was something that wasn't feasible, it's a mutual thing, but who's initiating, who puts it out there? So just the thought, the subtlety of this is important.
Really helpful.
It relates to the whole idea of how we change rituals. Because if you're going to try something out, you have to, the other person has to feel like they're along for the ride in making the shift, that it's not being dictated.
Mm-hmm.
So in any of my books for how to improve family life, I always end by saying, so what are some ways to try to make some changes without it backfiring?
Or getting that instant nope resistance, right?
Right. Right. So when I give community talks about any of this, I always end by saying, now, if you are inspired to make some changes in your family, your marriage, whatever, be very careful right now. If you're not here with your partner, if you're here with your partner, you're both fired up. That's good. But if you're here by yourself or without your kids, do not go home and say, we're now going to be an intentional family. Okay. because that comes across as a power move. Mm-hmm. It's a power move, even if you don't intend it. And then
you have the best of intentions.
Right. But yeah, what's coming down here? And then families are members are very good at sabotaging and resisting change. They don't very good at it.
Yeah. Without even recognizing, maybe, you know, what came to mind as you were saying that, I had a lady reach out to me who was a childhood friend of mine. And she said, you know, their routine with her and her daughter, she would pick her daughter up from school, an after school program. She'd be coming home from work. It'd be a bit later, late afternoon, early evening. And they would get takeout because, you know, they were rushed, they were hungry. And then they would, you know, get their food and go home and eat it. And that was kind of what they did. Mm-hmm. That was their routine. And all of a sudden the daughter started having some health issues and some allergies developing. And so they had to eliminate certain things from the diet and couldn't do the takeout anymore. Mm-hmm. And she said, you know, she had always thought that that was kind of the quickest, easiest thing that they were doing. And she didn't realize that, you know, they were spending a lot of time standing around waiting for the food to be prepared.
Oh, yeah.
And when they did, you know, have to start cooking at home, all of a sudden they had this new way of living where, you know, while the food was cooking in the oven, her daughter was sitting at the, you know, table doing homework and she could help her with her homework. And it became this new kind of after evening ritual that they didn't realize they were missing. So I thought that was a pretty cool story. But yeah, they might not have ever made that change unless they were forced to. Or yeah,
well, that's the benefit of I mean, if you can say this, the benefit sometimes of chronic health problems, right?
Yeah,
it's it means we don't take some things for granted. I have a colleague who says that a chronic health issue is a call to consciousness.
Mm-hmm. I ask everyone on my podcast who is on, you know, who's suffering with related health issues, asthma, allergies, anaphylaxis. I say, what's the silver lining? And that's the one that comes up all the time. There are silver linings.
Yeah.
It forces you to be really mindful about the time you spend with your kids and what do you want family life to be, because it's changing and going through that transformation. You become more mindful.
If you say, okay, we have to reinvent and restructure some things here.
Yeah.
And how do we want to do it? So this is a reboot. And how do we want to do it? Yeah. And this is what I think about parenting. You know, the two things that child psychologists talk about, researchers, love and limits. And I like to add a third L, and that is leadership. Okay. Because if we just think about love, it's what we offer them. Then limit setting is okay. But leadership is having a vision.
Mm-hmm.
And seeing if we can bring our kids along with it, and seeing if they can share the leadership. But it's bigger than love and limits.
I was thinking as we were talking as well about, you know, what really causes people to change. I think it's usually pain, right? They get to a point where all of a sudden they realize things aren't working, or or they're not ideal, or something isn't feeling right in my family. And so you know, that's what might inspire them to pick up a book such as this on intentional families, or just recognizing there's more, you know, this isn't my ideal, or this isn't how I envision things going. So then if you've got one person thinking that way, like you said, how do you get the rest involved and how do you get them on board? And you can't just, you know, force them.
right.
We're gonna do this. Yeah,
it's a continual family life is continual adjustments,
micro adjustments almost.
Right, right. And I have a colleague who talks about pinch points and crunch points. Okay, and it's better to engage the pinch points right before they get to the crunch. Like, you know, we're so busy, and In fact, even more so since my book came out, we favor kids' activities over the family in many ways.
Yeah.
So I always like to start with family meals, family dinners, because the research is really clear on this, that the single most important activity you can do in a day for and with your children is to break bread with them and have a conversation. That's more helpful for them socially, psychologically, academically, than the soccer and the other things that we prioritize. So because what happens is, as parents, we be more intentional about promoting our kids' academic and sports and other kind of aspects of life than we are about the family connection, including connections with extended family.
Yes.
Their junior high friends are going to be dim memories for the most part. Years, but their aunts and uncles and grandparents, and those are the real thing. But if we get into what they call a consumer mindset with children, that they are consumers of parental services. Well, then you don't force a consumer to do something they don't want to do. So they don't want to visit their grandparents, and they don't want to do this family thing because it's boring. Well, the leadership vision thing that we have to bear in mind. These are important relationships, even though in the short term, they would rather be with their friends. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't end when they're 18. my own kids now who are grown up and have their own kids. Remember that even after they were off in college, there would be family events that were, I call command performances. You know, grandma's 80th birthday and she was frail. Yeah. We're all going to get in the car and drive to Iowa. It's not a negotiation, right? I mean, it's just like, you know, she's turning 80 and everybody's gathering and they went. But when I have said this sometimes to parents when I give a talk, some of them are almost shocked because this idea that when they're 18, 21, that you would expect them to participate in an important family event. It's countercultural to this idea that they are independent, you know, adults. But that's not how family life works. I mean, my wife expects me to participate in lots of stuff.
Exactly.
But we can get into this mindset where our job is to raise these individual children to make it in the world themselves. I call it being a parental service provider. And thereby, we don't create a gravitational field around the family. And they don't have the same kind of experience in childhood. For one thing, they don't get to know their siblings that well. If all their sibling, all their activities are individual activities, so it's a parent driving a kid to hear that. The other thing, family activities, you got to be with your kid sister, your kid brother, your older, you know, pain in the rear. But there you are.
There you are. I agreed with that in the book. I read that part because it was something that had come up for me, you know, when my son got to that age, he's my older child, and mm-hmm. he stopped wanting to go apple picking, which was one of those things that we did, you know, every year. And all of a sudden he would rather be with his friends and not do it. And it was, I remember asking a fellow therapist, you know, do I make him go? And she's like, yes, you do.
Oh, good.
That's the thing, right? And you know, it's modeling the importance and commitment to family, even if they don't appreciate it now. You know, I do have a faith that they will really appreciate that when they're older and have their own family.
Yeah.
And remember there were times I didn't want to go. And I can remember being a teen and not being happy about being at my grandmother's 80th when I would have rather been out with my friends. And,
right.
But yeah.
Well, good for your friend, because a lot of friends, including some therapists, will say things like, well, he wouldn't enjoy it anyway.
Right.
He's just going to be a drag. and you can't force them to have a good time. And, you know, there's some rationale to that. It's not like that's silly, but it misses an important point about a ritual, a tradition. I mean, something that is important for your family. Isn't that's the thing about the ritual. We can sort of call ourselves to be faithful to it, as opposed to you had never done that activity before, and it was a random fall Saturday afternoon, and you said, "Hey, you want to go?" You know, do that. That sounds crazy. Yeah. That's a whole different thing, right?
Right.
Then this is something we do. Mm-hmm. It's a ritual. We do it, and you're at a point. Understandable that you know your friends are important. However, this is something we do. You know, when he's 25 and somewhere else, you're not going to haul him home to. But you might be expecting to come to a family wedding and a funeral.
Yep.
So
I remember I thought it was really cute because my kids are teenagers for the start of school, and they sent me a message that said, "What about our photo in front of the tree?" We always do our first, and I was really pleasantly surprised that they were actually asking about that, you know, that ritual of taking the photo out front of the tree. And
oh, that's wonderful.
I think they do appreciate it more than we might realize. Even if they're begrudgingly doing these things, and every year that I've taken that photo, they're, you know, "Come on, we just want to get going," and they're poking each other and fighting and doing all those things. Then, you know, when I actually, because I hadn't mentioned it and figured they were getting maybe too old for that and just kind of let it go because they weren't going to be here that morning. I was surprised when they came back to me and said, "Hey, what about our photo in front of the tree?"
I love it. You know, the evaluations that our kids have of us as parents, I don't think we should pay a lot of attention to those until they're 25.
Right.
At that point, their brains mature. They're able to actually compare families because, you know, often when they go away to college, they compare families. And they're able to look back and tell you what they liked and maybe some things they didn't like. At the time, mm-hmm. when they're 16, there are these other gravitational force fields. And you have to discern which are the ones to really insist on. So I have to tell you, your story reminded me, my wife and I recently celebrated our 50th wedding anniversary.
Congratulations.
Thank you. And we have two grown-up kids, and they're married with kids. One lives near us, another lives in another part of the U.S. And our two kids, their present for us was a weekend, just them and us, without spouses and kids. Sort of recreating the original
that family, yes.
And we did our old rituals. We did the Giovanni's pizza. We did you know, various things. And there was this really hilarious moment when we were having one of our favorite meals I had as a kid, and we had the Bee Gees on. I'm going to put the Bee Gees on because they grew up with the Bee Gees in the background. and we told them to sit at the heads of the table, and they've forgotten. They sat at the heads of the table. My wife and I sat across, and they asked us why. And I said, "Because it prevented you from kicking each other under the table."
Oh, that's so funny.
And so it was just a really special weekend. And it was those rituals that they remembered so well.
I remember reading an article too, you know, kind of in line with what you were saying about, you know, dinner or family meals being so important and actually one of the most beneficial things you can do for your kids. They were talking about just, you know, the kids knowing their extended family and being a part of, you know, hearing the stories of grandparents and, mm-hmm. and being a part of something bigger than themselves and, mm-hmm. and having that perspective. So, you know, when we talk about those traditions, being able to share those stories of, you know, this is the way, you know, we did things. And what was it like for you, you know, when you were a kid, and what were those things that you really remembered, and maybe getting some inspiration for, you know, if you went and cut the Christmas tree or things like that, it's like, oh, maybe we can bring some of those things back or just choose our own things that, you know, we want to remember.
And they also remember the things that go wrong. So in the book, I talk about family vacations, right?
Yes.
The most memorable vacations are when somebody ended up in the ER, you know, with a cut foot.
National Lampoon's, I'm thinking.
Yeah, right. Or the storm came, you know, the big thunderstorm, and we got flooded out, and so there's big rituals, like Christmas for those who do that, involve some things that go wrong. They involve some irritation, conflict, yeah. But that's part of it, and it's part often of the memories.
Yeah, I think you said in the book about, you know, the teen coming down to the dinner table if they're really mad or upset, you know, do you let them stay in their room? And it was like, no, we still want them at the table. Even if you're going to be miserable, you're there and your presence is valued however you show up, right?
Wherever you show up. That's right.
I used to do Peach and Pit with my kids. I'm not sure if you're familiar with that, or it's called Rose and Thorn, but we would go around the table and say, you know, what was your peach of the day? And what was your pit? And I was curious if you had an opinion about, you know, if you shouldn't do the pit part and talk about the negative part of the day, if you prefer it would just be positive, or if you had any opinion on that.
I think I know families that do it both ways. As long as there's complete freedom to say whatever you want. They don't really have to say something that's a real pit. But roses and thorns. I just talked to somebody recently. And with her kids, they do something I'm grateful for and something I hope for.
Oh, nice.
That was an interesting one, because the hope for often gave her insight into something they were a little worried about.
Mm-hmm.
Tomorrow, you know, I hope I pass the exam or something like that. I thought that was so. There's lots of different ways to do it, but it's a sharing with no grilling of anybody about it. And the other thing is that the parent shares too. The thing about ritual is that, particularly, you know, when kids are not just toddlers anymore, any ritual in which the parents share as equals it creates kind of an intimacy that doesn't happen in the regular, the parents in charge, the parent as the teacher, instructor.
Right.
You know, with a group of parents, we developed a bedtime ritual for a particular church, and there were these values that they would talk about one per day, like be kind to others, and then the child and the parent would both reflect on something that happened in the last week that made them think about be kind to others. And the kid would share, or they could pass, but the parent also shared.
Right.
Okay. And a lot of times our communication with kids is either logistical or instructive.
Okay. Instead of that more relatable and on
right.
That
not, not, there's a sort of a peerness.
Yes.
That we don't want that too much because, you know, you're the parent. But if the ritual calls on me to share, you know, a peach or a pit or something about a value, I'm taking my turn, and I'm not there to instruct my child to think differently or better. I'm just
right.
Sharing.
The radical acceptance of what was their genuine experience.
And they hear mine. That's the point I'm making. Right.
Yeah.
So I don't riff off what they're doing. I just let them say it. But I'm thinking about one of these other values in this this parent group was justice for all. And so one of the parents shared with her group of parents that with her child, her 8-year-old talked about something fair or not fair in the classroom. And then the mother, who is in HR, said that in the last week she had a chance to set something right, to correct something that was unfair to somebody, you know, in her work setting. And that's some of what she can do in her job that she really likes. When would she get a chance to share that?
Right.
I mean, you know, to an 8 or 9-year-old. So let me tell you about something great I did today at work, right? There wouldn't be an opening for that very easily, or it would be instructive. And this was intimate. Mom talking about something that she really she really felt good about at work.
I really felt that in the book as well, how you address like inclusivity of everyone in the family and how maybe, you know, sometimes we're really focused on our kids as parents and we forget, you know, to honor the other partner or to include them in, you know, these intentional, how we greet the person, you know, we greet the spouse. Sometimes, you know, we're so focused on what the kids are doing and that we forget about, you know, some of the other people living in the house. And the importance of that and also, you know, people dominating the conversation at the dinner table. You address that. How do you bring other people in and create that, you know, balance and address that? So I thought that was really helpful.
Yeah, if you're in a two-parent family and one of the parents does, you know, 80% of the parent talk, you might say there's probably a different personality and so on, but it kind of unbalances things. Mm-hmm. And so you can make, but you don't want to say you need to be talking more.
Right.
A lot of it is it's like a dance. You sort of let somebody lead a little bit, or you make some space, or you give them a question, or you don't immediately lead. If the kid brings up something and then you immediately lead with it, you pull back. It's like a dance. In fact, if you make some of this too conscious, it can scare the other person off because they feel like they have some performance. So you don't want people to feel performance pressure in a ritual, and you don't want to have conflict in a ritual. So I want to mention a meal ritual with the same group of parents where they light a candle and people hold hands and then they have a little ritual prayer they do. And one of the fathers in the group said his kids, his teenage boys, they would sometimes do the little prayer and a dan, 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 dan. And so what he did was he would just say, okay, let's do it again. And then they wanted their food, you know? Basically, We have to actually do this as designed in order to sit down and eat. But what he did not do was to say, now, come on, knock it off.
Right.
This is about family time here. You know, it's about respect. Right. You've lost it at that point.
Very rigid. And
yeah. But any kind of conflict. Now, sometimes if a kid is thrown, you have to. But the less you can do. So he simply said, let's do it again. I thought that was lovely. And it became an example of the best practice that we taught the other parents. Try to avoid disciplinary talk.
Or discipline, yeah.
Right. And like, you know, my parents' generation forcing kids to eat every bite, right? It doesn't do any good for their nutrition. It just creates power struggles. And it undermines the emotional significance of the ritual.
Oh my goodness. There's so much good stuff you're talking about here. I feel like I could talk to you all day. And I was curious if you wanted to share anything about the other work you're doing, because I am a therapist and I work a lot with families and couples in particular. I know you're doing a lot of work in discernment counseling. I'm very interested in taking that training and it's on my wish list of things to do. And you know, what things are you up to nowadays? What are your, you know, you mentioned the political stuff you're doing. And
yes, I'll just, oh yeah, I have lots of fun.
You wear lots of hats. You really do.
I enjoy that. So I'll just say a few words about the political depolarization front. So I've applied couples therapy principles to, in the U.S., what we call the red-blue divide, okay, the liberal-conservative divide, and variations of this are happening all over. Where people don't understand each other. They think the other person is not just ignorant, but, you know, has bad intentions. We don't know each other's worlds.
And it's othering, right?
So I helped to form a nonprofit called Braver Angels, in which we bring red and blue together in a structured process to try to understand each other beyond stereotypes and to see if they can find common ground. And it's sort of like a couple, you know, people polarize, they stop understanding each other. And as you know, as a therapist, what we do is we create an environment, a container, in which people can bring their best selves, which they can listen to each other. And that's what we do in Braver Angels. So it's very, very satisfying.
passionate topics. I was interested too, as you were talking throughout this conversation, just of the difference in families with COVID, you know, and how, you know, we're doing less activities. We've been locked at home. Yeah. Where I live, I'm in Canada. We've been locked down for a really long amount of time compared to the States. Like, they just shut us down. So we've had lots of family time. And, you know, for many families, I'm sure it is the first time where they've had dinners together every night and not rushing off to sports and that. So we go to those silver linings of, you know, it's not all bad.
Right.
But it can also highlight some of the places where we need to do some work. And
then a challenge, of course, the silver lining, when you've experienced the silver lining, then to try to hold on to some of that when things change. You know, so the post-COVID era, there has been more time for family connection. And let's hope people continue afterwards.
One of the things I often say with my couples is, you know, there's a lot of like, you always do this or you never did that. And I think it's the same when we're talking about intentional families, just because things were always one way or never, that doesn't mean we can't change it. And if we recognize that, you know, we have these intentions for, you know, what kind of family life we want to have, we can co-create those together. Not dictate it, but come up with, you know, and we can change and do that. So I loved how you suggested to implement these things.
You know, when kids get to be teenagers, they're able for the first time to finish this sentence. I come from the kind of family who... ... And a lot of that is what we do as a family. What we do one-to-one, what we do, you know, whether it's an active family and they go camping, whether it's a family that likes to have meals together, whether, you know, just like you're cooking now with your kids, they begin to identify the kind of family they come from that way. And then when they leave home and say they go off to college, for the first time they're doing comparisons. Now you're in my family, right?
Personally, yeah.
Yeah, and that's all good. They're shaping their own values for what they want in the future. And so the more intentional we are about that environment, that family environment, that, you know, the better memories we give, and the more our kids grow up really valuing family life.
I came from the kind of family who went to the grandma's 80th birthday party.
Yeah.
Right. Things like you said, right. I'll have parents complain to me, oh, my kids won't, you know, they don't care about writing a card to their grandma for their birthday. And I said, but you're modeling that for them as well. There's a huge power to just modeling it. And, you know, they might begrudgingly scribble something on a piece of paper because you force them to, but they take that with them throughout their life, or
they
that do. Value that my parent had that we write cards for.
That's right. You know, that's right. Yeah. So I grew up without an expectation we would do that. But my wife made sure our kids learned to do that. And now whenever we give something to the grandkids, we have four grandkids, there are notes and they're actually thoughtful. They actually say something about the present.
What's
part of my upbringing, but I love it. I love it. And you know, as you said, they didn't say, gee, oh, why don't I get to write a note now? You know, they and they're not just consumers of something. Okay, they are reaching out. They're expressing their gratitude and their thoughtfulness.
This has been amazing. Is there anything else you want to share before we run out of time?
No, I'm happy to talk about one of my favorite topics.
Yes. Yeah, thank you. I really, really enjoyed the book. I've had a few, I actually shared it in my most recent newsletter, and I've had a few people reach out and say that they intend to read it as well. And I thought the quiz, as I said, was very eye-opening, and it's just, it's been a good conversation starter. And when you mentioned, you know, teens are at that age, I thought, well, that might be even a great way to start the conversation.
Yeah, yeah.
Ask the question, how would you complete the sentence? Like, we are a family who,
yeah.
And if, you know, if you don't like the answers, or there's, you know, things that you can be, have a, you know, kind of like, I think of metacognition, thinking about thinking, we can have this, you know, cognition about how we live and actually set some intentions. Well, how do we want it to be? Like, is this in line with who we want to be?
But what, think about what we value as a family. The best question to get at that is, what's special and important about how we are living now? Okay. Yeah. What we do together, and then the values are there. Because what does it mean to just come up with the name of a value if it's not actually grounded in what we do?
Yeah. Oh, this has been amazing. Thank you so much for your time. I really look forward to sharing this podcast, and I'll put in the show notes all the relevant links as usual so that people can find your books and know how to reach out to you if they're interested in any of the work that you're doing and just to learn more about you and your initiatives. So
great. Well, it was a pleasure to do it. I really enjoyed our back and forth conversation and chance to be personal. You were personal. I had a chance to be personal too.
Thanks for listening to the Allergy Mom Podcast. For more information, recent blog posts, to subscribe to the newsletter, and more, be sure to visit theallergymom.com and follow The Allergy Mom on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook.